Alright, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and this is the Grim Articles Show Supplemental, where we do more AI and tech-related articles. So let's go ahead and get started. Future of Warfare. Robot dogs armed with AI-aimed rifles undergo U.S. Marine Special Ops evaluation. Quadrupeds being reviewed have automatic targeting systems but require human oversight to fire. So they're not just going to fire on you guys yet. The U.S. States Marine... The U.S. Marine Forces Special Ops Unit, Command, whatever we call it, MARSOC, is currently evaluating a new generation of robotic dogs developed by Ghost Robotics with the potential to be equipped with gun systems from defense tech company Onyx Industries, reports The Warzone. While MARSOC is testing Ghost Robotics' quadrupedal unmanned ground vehicles, called QUGVs for short, for various applications, including reconnaissance and surveillance, it's the possibility of arming them with weapons for remote engagement that may draw the most attention. But it's not unprecedented. The U.S. Marine Corps has also tested robotic dogs with rocket launchers in the past. Rocket launcher. MARSOC is currently in possession of two armed QUGVs undergoing testing, as confirmed by Onyx Industries staff, and their gun systems are based on Onyx Sentry Remote Weapon System, RWS, which features an AI-enabled digital imaging system and can automatically detect and track people, drones, or vehicles, reporting potential targets to a remote human operator that could be located anywhere in the world. Wow. The system maintains a human-in-the-loop control for fire decisions, and it cannot decide to fire autonomously yet. On LinkedIn, Onyx Industries shared a video of a similar system in action. Let's take a look. So, wow, this guy's literally using a backbone and a cell phone. And he can control a robotic dog to fire at a target. Wow. Kind of chilling, right? You say something bad to somebody on the internet, they'll stick their robotic dog on you and control it from their phone way out in whatever country, state. In a statement to The Warzone, MARSOC states that weaponized payloads are just one of many cases being evaluated. MARSOC also clarifies the comments made by Onyx Industries to The Warzone regarding the capabilities and deployment of these armed robot dogs should not be construed as a capability or a singular interest in one or of many use cases during an evaluation. The command further stresses that it is aware of and adheres to all Department of Defense policies concerning autonomous weapons. We got a little more here. The evaluation of armed robotic dogs reflects a growing interest in small robotic unmanned ground vehicles for military use. While UAVs, which are unmanned aerial vehicles, have been remotely delivering lethal force under human command for at least two decades, Obama especially was very familiar with those, the rise of inexpensive robotic quadrupeds, some available for as little as $1,600, has led to a new round of experimentation with strapping weapons to their backs. In July 2022, a video of a rifle bolted to the back of a Unitree Robo Dog went viral on social media, eventually leading Boston Robotics to other robotic vendors to issue a pledge that October, to not weaponize their robots, with notable exceptions for military uses. In April, we covered a Unitree GO2 robot dog with a flamethrower strapped on its back on sale to the general public. We covered that, remember? The prospect of deploying armed robotic dogs, even with human oversight, raises significant questions about the future of warfare and the potential risks and ethical implications of increasingly autonomous weapon systems. There are also the potential for backlash if similar remote weapon systems eventually end up used domestically by police. Such a concern would not be unfounded. In November 2022, we covered a decision by the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to allow the San Francisco Police Department to use lethal robots against suspects. There's also concern that systems will become more autonomous over time. As the Warzone's Howard Altman and Oliver Parkin describe in their article, while further details on MARSOC's use of the gun-armed robot dogs remains limited, the fielding of this type of capability is likely inevitable at this point. As AI-enabled drone autonomy becomes increasingly weaponized, just how long a human will stay in the loop, even for kinetic acts, is increasingly debatable, regardless of assurances from some in the military and industry. While the tech is still in early stages of testing and evaluation, QUGVs do have the potential to provide reconnaissance and security capabilities that reduce risk to human personnel in hazardous environments. But as armed robotic systems continue to evolve, it will be crucial to address ethical concerns and ensure that their use aligns with established policies and international law. Giving guns to AI, which is prone to hallucinations, what could go wrong? I know this won't bring much comfort to anyone, but the article didn't specify LLMs. There are object segmentation and decision-making algorithms that aren't stochastic neural networks. Okay, so there we go with that. Interesting and kind of scary. This might be a little outdated, but we do have to talk about it. Being acquired is a stepping stone to having your studio shut down. Gaming founders and CEOs speak out on the current state of the industry. We reached out to various video game studio owners following Microsoft's closure of Tango Gameworks, Arcane Austin, and more. This video comes off the heels of the Xbox showcase, which unveiled a slew of video games that I don't think any of us were expecting. A return to Gears, New Doom, and several other games that will appeal to a Western fan base. Xbox is going back to its core audience, which is the West. And I think it's going to be all the better for that. They're even bringing back Warcraft to consoles. World of Warcraft on consoles. Yeah, I know. And more Diablo. This week news of Microsoft shutting down several studios, including Tango Gameworks and Arcane Austin, has left an especially sour taste in the mouth of pretty much everybody. It's the latest entry into the acquisition Fallout saga, which seems to be one of the biggest hits in the video game industry right now. Activision Blizzard's post-acquisition cuts, Embracer Group recently gutting studios, remember that, ruthlessly gutting studios, sorry about that, it's bought. It begs the question, why would CEOs even want to sell their studios to one of these massive companies right now? To find out, we've reached to various CEOs and founding members of independent studios to give their thoughts under an assurance of anonymity. The answers we got back will likely match your assumptions. It can be avoided, if it can be avoided, an acquisition is absolutely something to avoid. This is especially the case now, with the bruises of recent news still sore, but recent reports have also emboldened pre-existing sentiments on the matter. Fuck no. It's just too clear that being acquired is a stepping stone on the path to having your studio shut down for no reason other than to meet a giant corporation's fiscal quarter goals. It's exactly what's going on. The source who wishes to remain anonymous told VG247, I guess if my only other option was to shut down anyway, we might as well get acquired to delay that a bit and line my pockets, but that's not the case right now. Another source provided some insight into the dangers of such acquisitions and why exactly companies like Tango Gameworks, even if they're successful, are getting cut from massive companies post-acquisition. I think everyone who enters into an acquisition knows what they're doing and that big companies operate in large-scale corporate strategies that can change in an instant. For a while, there was a feeling that streaming and subscriptions were the future, so a high volume of games was desirable. Then Game Pass slowed down, and the corporate strategy seems to have shifted back to fewer, bigger brands, which is a perennial slogan for most big publishers. This meant the smaller studios, those that weren't aligned with the big brands, and those that have had a recent failure were cold to align with it. The source continues. The challenge is that these big corporations, which are usually now run by sales or marketing people, don't understand how hard it is to build talent, to find a team that can work together to ship anything, and this process can take years. So they have a short-term gain of cutting costs, but they will have less teams to make games for them in the future. That said, when you sell your company, you're selling your ability to control or stop this in exchange for cash injection. And this story has repeated itself 100 times at Activision, Microsoft, and more. If you don't want to be at risk from the whims of corporate overlords, you shouldn't sell your company. Recent news has put a spotlight on Microsoft and its particularly dire fumble, but all interviewees I spoke to emphasize that this is by no means a problem unique to a particular company. Opinions on big acquisitions, regardless of the buyer, come with serious risks. I think today's news has further proven you can't trust anyone, one source states. Any publicly traded corporation is by definition only concerned about profits, growth, and appeasing shareholders. Embracer is the worst of them since they're run by a bunch of fuck-ups, but even the richest company in the world, Microsoft, is not your friend and will ruin lives to optimize the books. It doesn't matter how many podcasts Phil Spencer goes on to talk about the happy family of Xbox Studios. It's only until it's no longer convenient for them. Another CEO points to the complicated pros and cons one has to consider when a company, any company, comes around with a lot of money to offer you. You are always making decisions based on very specific concerns that are based in the now. How much cash flow do you have? How much security do you have? Do you have a publisher for your next game? How much money do you have in the bank and to keep you going while you search? It's all very subjective. Not many independent studios have huge cash reserves, so you're always doing what's best for your team and your game and your company. So I can completely imagine selling to a publisher or a first party, because that could make the most sense in the moment, but it's filled with risks and it changes how you need to operate. There's no such thing as a free lunch. One source found their long-held beliefs on acquisitions reinforced, with recent news only drawing a line under the topic. I've always held that position, so this hasn't done anything other than to reassure me that mergers and acquisitions usually always end poorly for game studios. The current state of things is that it sucks. So if being bought out is rough right now, what's the best position for a development studio to be in? The answer? Well, given the current state of things, there's no totally safe harbor for a developer. But being self-owned, not overbloated, and just having your own hands on the steering wheel feels like the way to go. The safest position is one unconcerned with growth. The more you scale, the more wildly successful you need to be to sustain your burn rate, one source puts it. Be satisfied with your studio size and make games that are sustainable for it. Yes! Great games come in all sizes. Yes! Let's not pretend like independence guarantees any kind of safety, but at least you're in control. Another emphasizes the risk of game dev in general, but also points to not chasing that temptation to overexpand as a helpful rule to work by. Games are a hit-based business. It changes rapidly, both in terms of audience and mood, so it's incredibly risky no matter where you are. It's not a business to get into if you're afraid of risk or crave eternal stability. I've moved country, let alone studio, twice in search of better projects, and that isn't for everyone. Our strategy is to stay small, stay a single game studio, focus all of the team's talents on one project, then move on to the next, trying to build a buffer in the bank. The more people you have, the bigger your monthly cost, which means you can run out of money fast if you're indie. But also, you can look like a big money hole if you're inside a publisher. Stay small, make fresh games, and try again. So, it's a rough time, guys. It's just a rough time, and of course, those are the devs' thoughts on it. Indie, I still think, is the way to go. Alan Moore's take on graphic novels goes viral on social media. Alan Moore is one of the most fascinating figures in the world of comic book fandom. I've read almost everything he's ever written. Because while he's a clearly beloved writer, CBR readers voted him as their all-time favorite comic writer in 2022, he can also go viral on social media every time he makes any criticism of the world of comic books. In fact, as we learned this week, Moore doesn't even need to make a new critique to go viral, as a brief interview the author made in 2014 has newly gone viral, as a video of the clip was shared on social media, and people who never saw the original are now responding with vigor to a sharp critique by Moore on the concept of serious books in general and graphic novels in particular. Moore has largely believed that comic books are for children. Yes, that's just his thing. He's largely believed that. And even though he's written some very, very risque comic books, and again, I've read almost everything but Lost Children, because Lost Children is a little It's got some weird vibes, guys. Just, you know, look it up. Moore made the comments while attending Fright Fest a decade ago to promote his then new Shudder anthology Showpieces, which I still haven't watched all of yet. A collection of three short films written by Moore and directed by Mitch Jenkins. Oh, by the way, he also released The Show, which I haven't watched, and that's supposed to be the big, you watch Showpieces and then you watch The Show. You know, that's how it's set up. While heading into Fright Fest, Moore was once again asked about Watchmen, the comic book industry, and his sharp response as the internet buzzing years later. Moore's comments from 2014 were shared on David Dunlop's social media on Wednesday, and the comments have already been seen by a million. Oh yeah, that's fine. So he says, Moore explains how he regrets how Watchmen gave cover to fans and pretend that comic books are for adults now. Again, exactly what I just told you guys. I've got the biography of Alan Moore in his autobiography in his own words. I've read it, cover to cover. I know exactly how he feels about comics and the occult and all that sort of thing. Which Moore believes just gave fans cover to continue to read trash. Thanks to Rich Johnson for the precise quote. If you remember in the 80s, there were tons and tons of headlines just saying, bam, sock, pow, comics have grown up. And like they hadn't. There were about three or four halfway decent comic books, and the rest of it was still the same juvenile rubbish that had been produced for the last 40 or 50 years. What the comic boom of the 80s did was grant a license to a lot of people not to have to actually grow up. Moore saved his sharpest ire for the term graphic novel, noting by calling them graphic novels, which was a term that I hated, because they're not particularly graphic and they're certainly not novels. Usually they're 12 issues of She-Hulk stapled together. That is not a novel. What I think happened, and yes, he knows what a novel is. I've got Jerusalem. And I can't get through it because Moore loves architecture so much he could talk about it for 4 or 5 pages. And I'm not shitting you. Apparently the story is amazing to the occultist friends I had that read it. And, it's supposed to be, it's a pretty big read. It's like War and Peace, guys. But actually interesting. And yes, it's a first edition, but it's also a doorstop. Like, I mean, I don't really use it as a doorstop, but it can be used as a doorstop. So, Moore saved it. Alright. What I think happened was that a lot of people who were just interested in the adventures of Green Lantern, even though what they were 30 or 35 or 40, having Watchmen gave them away, saying, oh, I'm not emotionally retarded. I am reading, this is a graphic novel that is for adults. No, it's not. It's the same comics you've been reading for ages. I'd feel happier about it if graphic novel actually meant something more than it does at the moment, which is big, expensive comic, and that's pretty much all it means. Now, there may be some differences. I won't say that a lot of the books we've been covering are high quality. Maybe Invisibles. Maybe some people could say Invisibles to some extent. But, you know, Fathom, Vampirella, Evil Arnie, Lady Death. It's all very, like, it does have a juvenile sense, but that's fine. Because we don't necessarily, like, I disagree with Moore. We don't have to grow up when it comes to our entertainment. That doesn't mean we can't enjoy mature entertainment, but it doesn't mean that we have to limit ourselves to that kind of entertainment. Like, it's Mega Man Day, guys. It was Mega Man Day, June 9th. And the fan community released Make a Good Mega Man Level 3, which is a very massive 200-plus stages game with 300 mini-games. And I've been playing through it, and it's, you know, all adults. We're all fairly older. We're in our 30s and 40s now, guys. I remember these people when I was in my 20s. And they're still working on the games, they're still making Mega Man because Capcom really doesn't work with it. And Mega Man is something we all grew up with. And we're just 30s and 40s and we don't necessarily want to grow up. We want to continue to make these great games that we love and play through these great games that we love, because the developers almost are kind of trying to tell us to do so. They're like, oh, we're not going to make any more Mega Man games because that doesn't appeal to the children of this age. And we're trying to make the Monster Hunter and the more Street Fighter, even though Street Fighter is fairly old too now. And of course, the Resident Evil games. So, that's fine. They did do an Ace Attorney, a couple Ace Attorney things. So, I mean, there was that. But yeah, the Blue Bomber, he just hasn't seen that much love aside from that mobile game that they made offline. Which is fun and definitely a love letter to Mega Man. But it's a grindy mess, and I felt like I'd spent way more time on it than I needed to after playing it for 8 hours straight. Oh, I enjoyed it, sure, but I realized I was spending too much time doing much of nothing. And that's when I felt like it was time for me to drop that game. Oh yes, I definitely paid for it. It wasn't a pirated game. I bought the game. But at the same time, guys, yeah, it just didn't feel like I was enjoying it as much as I should have. But yeah, back to what we were talking about here with Moore. Moore's comments going viral and the reaction of some comic book fans to Moore's dismissal of superhero comic books evokes a defense in his daughter. Leah Moore developed in response to similar comments he made in 2019, which is that the superhero comic book industry only has itself to blame for alienating her father. Oh, that's true. That's true. He talks about his disdain in the biography quite a bit. Part of that is his fault for signing a contract without getting a notary to read it. He thought that they would give him back his heroes after Watchmen. And they told him, by word of mouth, not by signed agreement, that, oh, sure, yes, when you're done with Watchmen, we'll give you the characters and you can write whatever stories you want with them. And a young Moore signed the dotted line, and then DC said, well, you know what? You've signed the characters over to us, so we can do whatever we want with them. Thank you. And he was very, very mad about that, but it's his fault for not getting a notary and really looking through it and trusting them at their word. Something he regrets all his life. She explained that her father loved superhero comics. Remember, it was Super Duper Man, which I've actually read last year in the Mad collections that I have. And that's what got him into comic books. And that her father loved superhero comics so much that he tried to make them into something that provoked thought and feelings and addressed issues that spoke to people the way that superheroes had spoken to him. It seems crazy to me. I have his collection of Marvel books, dog-eared from reading from love. I heard so many times about his excitement at finding a stash of secondhand Marvel books in a junk shop, in a box, or buying them off the spinners in Great Yarmouth on holiday. He could not love superhero comics more if he tried. Jack Kirby was his idol. Ditko was his idol. However, she continued that the medium that he adored was ruled by corrupt despots, as it was, it still is. That the people who made that magic were abused, and that their contribution was not valued, that it was stolen from them. He already hated that before Watchmen. He already knew Kirby had been shafted, which absolutely did happen. So when it happened to him, and again, remember, he started his own label, ABC America's Best Comics, with, what's it? Wildstorm, right? And Wildstorm was an independent company until DC bought them. And as soon as DC bought them, he destroyed his entire universe. And he already had, okay. And then again, it wasn't just a business deal gone awry or a bit of bad luck. It broke him. The whole thing he loved most, the thing he poured all his time and energy into for his whole entire life, he couldn't do it anymore. So if any of you are further interested in Alan Moore, Alan Moore's long-awaited bumper book of magic. This isn't a cult book, so if you consider yourself religious, do not purchase this book. Just do not do it. If you think you're going to let loose spirits or things like that, just do not buy this book. But for those that are more interested in such things, the book will be coming out in October, and it will be a hardcover. I don't know if there's going to be a PDF version of it. I'm going to buy a copy, absolutely. I've been waiting on this book for over 20 years, so I definitely want to read this. This is supposed to be the true Promethea. Promethea is one of my favorite, if not favorite, comic of all time, and I've got every single issue. Like, as a, you know, the volumes. I've read them over and over. There's certain things. When I was definitely studying occult, I took a lot from that. And I still take a lot from that now. I still think there's some very powerful things that Moore has said. And he says that this is going to be a more, like, a realized version of that. So I'm definitely looking forward to the bumper book. I know it's going to be an amazing read. I haven't actually sat down and read a physical book in a while. So this will be a great one to jump on. It's actually fairly priced too. So if you want to pick it up, go ahead and do that. I think Amazon has it. So I'm definitely getting my copy. I should be pre-ordering it. Maybe I should pre-order it right now while I'm here, so we can kind of discuss it, because I would, let's see here, it's being put out by Top Shelf, of course. In the UK, it's a different company, I believe. Whoops. Yeah, it's called the Moon and Serpent Bumper Book of Magic. Yep, let me look at my money. Yeah, I think I can do this. We'll see right now. I'm gonna pick this old thing up. Yeah. Just gonna take a slight little break here. All right. Not feeling incredibly great today, as you guys might be able to tell. Yeah, maybe. I'll pick it up. Oh, wow. I have a gift card balance. I'm getting it for free? So, yep, I didn't have to pay anything for it. I had a gift card balance. Cool. So, I'm getting the bumper book now. I might talk about it. It is going to be physical, so I can't just, like, I definitely can't read it on the show. And I don't think it's something you guys would probably want me to read. I don't know. Like, I really don't want to go into, like, my full occult mode, because some of you guys are religious and I want to kind of respect everybody's thing. I grew up with religion, so I am very, very well aware of the kind of, you know, the territory here. I know. But I have my own way of looking at things. We'll just say it like that. So, all right. Final Fantasy III's programmer is so legendary that people are starting to think it took 16 years to bring back the JRPG because nobody else could replicate his code. Nasir Jebeli's legend continues to grow. Now, this is pretty fascinating, guys. There was a 16-year gap between the 1990 release of Final Fantasy III on the Famicom and its 2006 remake on Nintendo DS, and a 31-year gap before the Pixel Remaster brought something more akin to the original game to a new platform. That might be because the original game's legendary programmer was so good that nobody could replicate his code. The programmer is Nasir Jebeli, an Iranian-born man with royal ties, who moved to the U.S. to study computer science and avoid the 1979 Iranian Revolution. I've got a friend of mine that has some stories about that. He is Iranian. His parents left to escape the Shah. His early games were legendary among PC enthusiasts of the time, to the point where Doom co-creator John Romero once called him my number one programming god, my idol. Nasir, the name by which he was typically credited in his games, eventually began to work with Squaresoft, first on games like 3D Runner and Rad Racer before programming the first three entries in the Final Fantasy series. 1 and 2, of course, would enjoy numerous ports and remakes for other platforms in the years that followed, but it wasn't until 06 that 3 ended up on another platform. And it wouldn't be until 2021 that the Pixel Remaster brought the original game to a new audience. According to an article from Japanese outlet MagMix, translated by Automaton West, Nasir's programming skills might just be the reason for that gap. Rumors have long held that the high-speed airship movement in that game was impossible to replicate on other post-NES platforms, and as Automaton summarizes, Nasir's code for the system astounded other programmers. Although it is rumored that Gibelli exploited a bug to achieve this, he managed to fit the processing of the airship's movement into 1/60th of a second, which included the loading and displaying of map data, ocean and waterfall animations, as well as the shadow casted by the airship. A programmer interviewed by MagMix attests that fellow programmers at the time were unable to recreate what Gibelli had done, and that even those who were in position to read his source codes found them difficult to comprehend. There was actually a port of Final Fantasy III in development in the early 2000s for the WonderSwan Color handheld, but it was eventually cancelled despite the fact that Final Fantasy 1, 2, and 4 all made it to the platform. In a very old Eurogamer interview, longtime Square dev Hiromochi Tanaka explained that when we developed FF3, the volume of content in the game was so huge that the cartridge was completely full, and when new platforms emerged, there simply wasn't enough storage space available for an update of FF3, because that would have required new graphics, music, and other content. There was also a difficulty with how much manpower it would take to remake all of that content. Is Nasir's penchant for programming tricks the reason why it took so long for Final Fantasy to reach the platforms? Other platforms, rather. There's no way to put a definitive yes or no on that at this point. But it's a great story, and I think it's the most important part. Very, very, very fascinating. I haven't even seen the future game showcase yet. I'm behind, okay? Alright, what do we got? China's homegrown general purpose humanoid jogs out at 6 miles an hour. 6 kilometers an hour. Kilometers. Kilometers, Grim. Kilometers. We don't say kilometers. The Beijing Humanoid Robot Innovation Center has envoyed Tiangong, an electrically driven general-purpose humanoid that's capable of running at 6 kilometers an hour while also being able to tackle slopes and stairs in blind conditions. It's gonna run after you. You insult President Xi! You insult President Xi! Attack! Attack! Okay, the Beijing Humanoid Robot Innovation Center was set up in November last year as the first provincial-level humanoid robot innovation center in China, and is part of a new tech hub that's home to more than 100 robotics companies coming together to form a complete industrial chain for core components, applications, development, and complete robot builds. The company is a joint venture from Beijing Yaizong Investment Holdings Limited, UBTech Robotics, Xiaomi, and Beijing Jincheng Machinery Electric. Wow, that is a mouthful. Its aim is to undertake 5 key tasks, including the development of the general-purpose humanoid robot prototypes and general-purpose large-scale humanoid robot models. Its open-source Tiangong Humanoid is built as the world's first full-size humanoid robot capable of running solely on electric drive, though there do seem to be other contenders in the space, including Unitree's H1 and Boston Dynamics' newly reborn Atlas. Let's take a look at him. Obviously, we're not going to do that. Alright. April 27th. There's all the Chinese billionaires. Okay, can study home services, industrial manufacturing, other industry applications according to the personalized needs of the market and users. It can further promote large-scale commercial applications, and right now is looking like it needs to use the bathroom. At the launching ceremony, Tiangong demonstrated, can run 6 kilometers an hour. It can navigate slopes and stairs, promptly adjusting its gait as needed. It's 163 centimeters and it weighs 43 kilograms. Robot is equipped with multiple vision sensors, boasting a processing power of 550 trillion operations per second. And they told me we'd never get them walking. We got them walking and we got them running. Look at that. It felt like it in a way, you know. It's kind of running like Rocky and going up those stairs. Come on, Rocky. You can do it. Like the H1, the general purpose humanoid lacks human-like hands at this stage of development, but is reported capable of jogging along. Oh, it's 3.7 miles an hour. That's not too bad. Thanks to something called state memory-based predictive reinforcement imitation learning. That means it'll take a while to kill you, but it will kill you. It just, you know, it takes it a while. It's not quite there yet. I'm coming to kill you. Just give me a second. It takes a while. I only go 3 miles an hour. It can also take on slopes and stairs without relying on its 3D vision centers, adjusting its gait as it goes. The bot is kitted out with 6 Axis Force centers too. Sensors, not centers. For accurate force feedback. The Tiangong humanoid we've talked about. It's 5'4". So it's a hobbit. From toe to top and tips to scales at 43 and 95 pounds. Well, I can pick it up. It runs on a 48-V15-AH battery. I don't know what that means, guys. And the arms have 3 degrees of freedom and leg joints have 6. It features advanced inertial measurement units and has onboard Wi-Fi. As for processing brains, the developers boast it's capable of 550 trillion operations per second. Other details are pretty thin on the ground at the moment, but as well as going on to take our jobs in manufacturing and fulfillment centers, its open source and compatible scalability could see it enter service as a home bot or as a research tool. I don't know,
guys. It sounds interesting, but gotta see it in action a little more. What is this?
Oh, this is interesting. Normally I wouldn't cover this on this show, but I think this is worth it. The Katy Perry Act was launched in response to Katy Perry and Orlando Bloom's suit with a veteran. Katy Perry and her fiancé, Orlando Bloom, were once involved in a rather tricky lawsuit with a veteran homeowner who sold them his house back in 2020. Carl Westcott's property was purchased by the celebrity couple for a whopping $15 million in July 2020. But the 84-year-old, who claims to have been on several intoxicating, pain-killing opiates at the time, apparently did not want to sell his home. Court papers suggest he was diagnosed with Huntington's disease, a genetic brain disorder, in 2015. And just days before the contract was drawn up, Westcott underwent a major 6-hour surgery on his back, which led to him being placed on multiple opiate medications. Documents from the Los Angeles County Superior Court argued that the multiple opiate medications, which were a synthetic form of morphine, disoriented and intoxicated him, depriving him of reason and understanding with respect to the terms and consequences of the contract, and seriously impaired his mental faculties to the point he was of unsound mind and not competent to give his free, voluntary, or intelligent consent to the contract. The contract that he signed to sell his home is therefore void or voidable. Westcott's son, Chart, and the rest of the family are now fronting an act called Protecting Elder Realty for Retirement Years Act. I like this idea. The act has also been dubbed the Katy Perry Act. The website states that the Katy Perry Act addresses the risks of elder financial abuse, especially as it relates to property and not real estate and real estate sales and transfers. The act establishes a 72-hour cool-down period during which either party involved in a contract for conveyance of a personal residence in which one party is over the age of 75 can rescind the agreement without penalty. The act's page reflects on elder fraud or financial elder abuse as being a rampant issue in the U.S.
In fact, the prevalence of online fraud targeting seniors increased by 400% in recent years, according to the FBI. There was even, again, The Beekeeper. That movie is based on it. Very good movie. The Federal Trade Commission also reported that in 2020, individuals aged 60 and older filed over 93,000 complaints related to fraud, with reported losses exceeding $500 million. The Katy Perry Act was launched in response to Katy Perry and Orlando Bloom's suit with a veteran. Additionally, the rate of cognitive impairment and or dementia are 15% by age 75 and 20% by age 80. It concludes there are no laws to protect senior citizens against real estate transactions that unfairly target older individuals whose mental capacities may be compromised at time of sale. The Perry Act addresses the risk of elder financial abuse, especially as it relates to property and real estate sales and transfers. So there we go. That's a good thing, I think. Google is building a fart button into Android. This is a bit old, but, you know, I haven't actually gotten a chance to cover it. I simply don't know how to feel about an incoming update to the Google Phone app that adds sound effects to the Android dialer. First spotted as part of a beta update, the app may soon let you tap one of six audio emoji buttons to play a short sound clip that both sides of the call can hear. There's clapping, laughing, crying, a sad sliding trombone. Oh! They should have, you know, partying, a drum sting, and poop, which emits a fart sound. You can access the buttons during a call by tapping, no, I'm not doing the fart sound here, by tapping the option in the dialer's overflow menu or with a small flag position towards the bottom. The dormant adolescent in me wants to try the poop button at least once with a trusted friend who won't disown me for having a questionable sense of humor. Personally, I'd much rather hear these sounds except farts in my conversations as organic, genuine reactions. Who will actually get meaningful use out of this feature after that novelty wears off? If we're going to do this, I'd love to see user-customizable audio, plus perhaps pre-recorded messages and text-to-speech shortcuts. This initial list covers the basics, but I think it might be missing the mark a bit. Realistically, this could all just be a product of boredom from one of Google's engineers, and it's alright if that's how far this goes. Just please don't spam your loved ones with it unless your goal is to get them off the phone as soon as possible. Thankfully, there's a cooldown period that limits how often you can use the effects. Google I.O. is coming up May 14th, so hopefully by then we'll get further insight into its thinking for this one. Again, this is a very old article. Okay, so we talked about this already with the Neuralink patient and basically how he was gaming. Yeah, we talked about that. Who are the big four in nu metal? How about that? Nu metal's always been a favorite of mine. It seems like it's just a poll. I guess they've already decided. Let's see. What do we got? Cold Chamber, Deftones, Disturbed, Evanescence, Godsmack, Korn, Limp Bizkit, Linkin Park, Machine Head, Mudvayne, Mushroomhead, POD, Papa Roach, Seven Dust, Slipknot, Stain, Static X, or System of a Down. Every single one of these bands, the exception of Evanescence, I do listen to on a regular basis. All of them. Every single one of them. So, all right, guys. Next article. Not a big deal there. That was a waste. What is this? Oh, an exoskeleton. Okay, this might be pretty cool. Apparently, this is a free article. It's not that long. Good. New Densys X1 exoskeleton changes workouts and walks. So this is kind of neat. An exoskeleton can save a worker's back or can give them the strength to lift a 200-pound airplane tire, not a 200-airplane pound tire. I don't know what you were thinking, Forbes. Remember, a professional editor worked on this piece. The Densys X1 is the first exoskeleton for consumers. This wearable workout assistant is affordably priced at $600 on Kickstarter, where over 975,000 have been pledged as of this writing. I've been writing about a wearable augmentative excuse me. Yeah, Augmentive Tech XR for 10 years, and I've demoed at least half a dozen exoskeletons over the years at events like Enterprise Wearing Wearable Technology Summit, EWTS, and CES. So what does it do? What does it make me Iron Man? I don't see much. Okay, does it make him run faster? Okay. Can he lift heavy objects? Just see a bunch of people climbing mountains and shit. I don't really get the idea of it. It's like wearing an Oh, it's strength training. So you can make it more difficult to run. But can't you just weight yourself? Like you can wear weighted clothes or something? Like Goku? Like Goku had an idea. You just wear weighted clothes. Universe Today! Alright, how fucking huge is this article? Wow! Astronomers are on the hunt for some Dyson spheres, guys. This one's a bit long. Come back to that a little bit. Let's see. Wow. Yeah, we'll go with the universe stuff a little later. Cover that. In another one. Let's do something fun. Well, this is a little long too. Damn. Anything short? We'll go with that later. Alright, so guys, I'm gonna go ahead and jump this one. And we'll go ahead and probably do another one later on. I want to try to do more of these to get the articles kind of down. You see, all this shit is articles that we have to cover. All the stuff at the top are articles. So I'm trying to do as many as I can. But obviously the melatonin I took about 6 hours ago is starting to affect me, which is weird. But it is what it is. So, all right, guys. I'll see you guys next time on the Grim Articles Show with more articles. And we'll start right here covering the universe, covering some AI and other stuff. So, stay tuned.